This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Let's get, though, to the markets and the market drivers report. Let's set your Business Week agenda on this Monday. And joining us is Kriti Gupta, Bloomberg Markets correspondent, and Katie Greifeld, Bloomberg News cross-asset reporter, Quick Take co-anchor as well with Tim, both of them on the phone in our New York City bureau. Kriti, let's start with you. Talk to us about the dynamics of this trade, and I am curious about volume, which to me speaks to conviction in terms of the selling.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that take. The idea that if you do have higher volume, you do tend to see more conviction. What's important to note about it this time, though, is when you also see higher volume, it also means that you are going to likely see a higher VIX as well. And that is a call that some people are saying is kind of signaling the end of the selling period, essentially a bullish signal. You have also talked about the VIX inversion, the idea that volatility is going to be higher now than in the future. At least that's what the bets are making. So put all of that together, and you are already starting to see some of the declines that were as much as 3% on the S&P 500 turn around. But keep in mind, yes, it's a tech-led sell-off, but remember, tech also led the stock market to those gains. It's only natural to see it lead the decline as well.
Hey, Katie Greifeld, come on in here, because I know you've been watching this closely as well. I'm wondering, if we're not thinking about it from a technicals perspective and we're thinking about it from an earnings perspective, and this kind of kicked off last week with Netflix and that big miss when it came to at least what they were thinking in terms of subscribers for the upcoming quarter, the current quarter. Tech earnings this week. Plus
Microsoft,
the Fed.
Apple, Tesla, right? Some big ones.
IBM today after the bell.
There's a lot.
What's more important in terms of a catalyst to have a bottom or move higher off of this week? Is it tech earnings or is it the Fed?
I'm going to say it's the Fed. I really think that is the main catalyst this week. But yeah. I mean, to your point, Tim, earnings haven't been the cushion that they have been. But I mean, even just zeroing in on today's price action, which you never want to do too much of, but we had a bond auction at 1 p.m. Typically, they aren't that exciting, but this was the 2-year tenor and it was very strong. You saw a lot of demand here, and that's the tenor that would really be under pressure if we were expecting to see a much more aggressive Fed. But people want to buy bonds right now, at least in the primary market. That tells you that maybe some of the Fed pricing that we're seeing, maybe it's a little bit aggressive. And I think that ties in with the intraday rebound that we are seeing in the NASDAQ 100, even though that index is still negative. It's well off its lows of the session.
Well, and that's a really good point. And it all speaks to, you know, in terms of the Fed, what we get from the Fed tomorrow, Kriti, I think about in terms of specifics, right? No doubt about it. You know, we are all ready for policy changes when it comes to the Federal Reserve, but we haven't gotten a lot of specifics, especially from Jay Powell, in terms of how quickly we do it, how fast, how aggressive. And that's what we could get tomorrow that could really kind of set this trend to the upside or the downside in real motion.
Yeah, and to your point, I think there's two pieces of the equation, two questions that we don't have answered yet. And one of the big ones is going to be the balance sheet reduction. And I think a lot of traders are going to be looking for that. Yes, we know that's going to happen later in the year. What we don't know still is how it's going to happen. We don't know whether it's going to mean actively selling bonds on the open market or whether it means buying shorter security bonds and letting them kind of roll off, essentially not reinvesting some of the money that they traditionally would when bonds roll off. So that's going to be major because that both methods have very different market reactions. The actively selling bonds on the open market is a far more volatile reaction. So that's going to be question number one for the Fed. Question number two is, of course, is there going to be a potential 50 basis point rate hike on the table in March?
That is crazy.
Well, I mean,
come on.
Let's talk about, though, I mean, what's interesting to me, and I agree with you, it is a pretty out there call, but what's interesting to me is that the actual bond market is only priced in 27 basis points, but traders have made the leap that because it's more than 25, therefore it's pricing in a 50 basis point hike, which is an interesting logic.
I will eat mashed potatoes if that's the case, because I really hate mashed potatoes. I'm just going to put it out there. All right, you guys can hold me to it.
All right, we'll hold you to it.
But that's going to be something to see if he even acknowledges that that's a possibility.
Yeah.
Katie, just in 20 seconds, crypto. We can't have you here without talking crypto, because guess what? Bitcoin's actually higher right now.
Now.
It's
fallen a lot.
Yeah, it's fallen 50% from its highs. That's the important context there.
Yeah, don't blink. Again, I'm just going to tie that to that tech trade. If you look at the correlation between Bitcoin and the NASDAQ 100, the 40-day correlation, it's never been higher. So that ties into this entire story we've been talking about. So Bitcoin to bonds. There you go.
Bitcoin basically a tech stock now.
Bitcoin to bonds.
Yeah.
It's like a, I don't know, a t-shirt or something.
I know. Oh, you can do that one.
All right. Mashed potatoes. You can hold me to it. Katie and Creedy, thank you.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We talked about some of the top COVID headlines that are out there. The UK is going to stop requiring vaccinated travelers. Pfizer and BioNTech saying a pair of laboratory studies confirming that three doses of their COVID-19 vaccine produce antibodies that can neutralize the Omicron variant. I feel like I'm watching a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
It's like dun-dun-dun-dun.
The last 2 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, you know, there's also some mixed news coming from New Jersey. We're seeing that an increasing number of severe cases of COVID-19 among children in New Jersey. It's also fueled some outbreaks in nursing homes and other long-term facilities. That's according to the state's health commissioner.
All right. That's good to know. That's my home state. Like, back on Bloomberg, a voice that we always respect when it comes to the pandemic, Dr. Sandro Galea. He's Dean and Professor at Boston University School of Public Health. He's got a book out that's called The Contagion Next Time. He is with us once again on the phone from Boston. Dr. Galea, nice to have you back with us. How are you? And what do you think are the most important headlines when it comes to this pandemic that we should be paying attention to?
Hello, Carol. Hello, Tim. Happy New Year. Well, it's been 2 years, as you both said. I appreciate you were saying it's like a bit like being in a Marvel movie. It's been a long 2 years, and I think we're at a point where many of us are beginning to feel like there could be hope. Now, just to summarize, the Omicron variant, which came and really performed like it had in South Africa and the United Kingdom, which had a very rapid rise, and now we're seeing that we've peaked and heading into a rapid fall, which should, over the next few weeks, return us back to where we were before Omicron. And I think what many are expecting is that after that, we'll have a period of stability at low rates of COVID. And you've heard a lot of discussion around, will we move to an endemic phase? And, you know, endemic just means that a disease is around and we're used to it. And, you know, tuberculosis is endemic, malaria is endemic. So there's no magic number as to when something becomes endemic. It simply means when we settle on a level that we say we're learning to live with this disease. Now, when that is, of course, ultimately is a judgment call as to when we as a country and when the world gets there. And of course, the big fear remains on my mind, on everybody's mind, is that there will be another variant that we're not expecting. I mean, that's the big question mark in all this, because if there is another variant that we're not expecting, we don't know its characteristics, and that could be a game changer.
And that could still happen, right?
It could certainly still happen, and I don't think you'll be able to find anybody who'll come on your show and say that's not going to happen, because we simply don't know. Now, the hope is, and you know, Dr. Fauci mentioned this in a talk he gave recently, that Omicron becomes effectively a live attenuated vaccine, and that means that, you know, for many diseases we vaccinate through a mild form of the disease itself, and many people who are not vaccinated through any of the vaccines out there have actually gotten Omicron, which means that they've actually also been vaccinated effectively by getting the disease. So the hope is that between those of us who are vaccinated through Pfizer or Moderna, et cetera, and those who were not vaccinated but got Omicron, that there are enough people vaccinated that the reservoir of people who are naive to COVID is relatively few. And by naive, I mean that means that they're susceptible to getting the disease.
But, and we're talking about the United States, and I think, you know, a concern a lot of people have is a variant of concern emerges outside of the United States and a place that is even more unvaccinated than developed countries. Hey, Dr. Galea, I'm wondering about the natural progression of a virus like COVID-19. Shouldn't it, as it makes its way through populations, is it the type of thing that gets more transmissible but less severe naturally?
Yeah, that's correct. That is generally what we expect. I feel like every time we talk about COVID, one has to say generally, because of course we've had many exceptions in the course of COVID. But fundamentally what happens in the evolution of these viruses is that there are fewer people who are susceptible. So in order for the virus to survive, it needs to become more transmissible. And in order for it to survive, it needs to become actually less severe, because if a virus kills its host, then it actually cannot transmit itself. So there is a natural evolution towards more transmissible, less severe. Having said that, there are exceptions, and there could well be exceptions. And as you said, it is of particular concern in places where you still have large numbers of people who are unvaccinated and among whom COVID is circulating. I mean, this, the Omicron came from South Africa, as we all know. So certainly if Omicron has taught us anything, or if COVID has taught us anything, right, is that the whole world is connected and we are all healthier if everybody's healthier.
Dr. Gley, I want to go back to the transition from pandemic to endemic that you and Carol were speaking about a little earlier. What is your definition of endemic? What needs to happen for you to say to yourself and to say to us, this is no longer a pandemic, it's endemic?
Fundamentally, to get something to endemic, it means it has gotten to a level that we have learned to live with it, that we have adjusted our society and we are back to doing our business, our daily business, our professional business, our living, our life, and in a way, and living with the disease. And in a way, for example, I mean, flu is endemic. It comes in cycles and we live with it. We don't disrupt what we do because of the flu. We don't disrupt what we do for any number of diseases. So it really, to my mind, would be a return to our next normal living. Now, I say the word next intentionally because it's not unreasonable to have some changes that one makes recognizing that you are now living with some other new disease that you weren't living with before. But by and large, the expectation is that we will go back to where we were. You know, some diseases are so rare, Tim, that endemicity is zero. So if you have to give one example, for example, something like meningitis.
Right, right.
Meningitis in the United States is very rare. So even a single case or two becomes pandemic, right? Because endemic levels are zero. But those are some diseases. But many diseases, endemicity is some level. It's a level that we live with. I mean, there's an endemic of heart disease, endemic of lung disease.
Right.
It could be an endemic of COVID.
Dr. Sandra Galea, thank you so much. He is Dean at the Boston University School of Public Health, joining us on the phone from Boston. Check out his new book, The Contagion, next time, because guess what, everybody? There's probably going to be a next time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we've talked often about the amount of money out there available for startups and new ventures. Turns out one area attracting a lot of VC money is publishing startups, both here in the United States, also over in Europe. So let's get a little bit more on that story.
Yeah, I love talking the news business. And it's not just because of, you know, one
really?
Of my favorite words, solipsism,
really?
Right?
Yeah,
the idea
exactly.
that we only exist. But let's get into it with Joel Weber, who's editor at Bloomberg Business Week on the remote access line in Brooklyn. Also joining us is the author of a story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. It's Alex Webb. He's a correspondent for Bloomberg Quick Take. He joins us on the phone from London. Joel, I want to start with you. Is it a good time to be in the news business right now?
Well, I don't know if any business is a good business like right now. Like
yeah,
everything.
Sorry,
seems,
I don't mean today. You know,
air.
With the sell-off that yeah. we're seeing, but you know what I mean, because this is one that is, you know, is fundamentally changed by the advent of the internet.
Yeah. So seasonally, if we step back okay. from just today, seasonally there is a lot of money that is sloshing around, and it likes what it sees. In publishing, which is not something that you often hear, but I think as Alex will tell us here, what makes this time different, Alex?
The news industry has almost stumbled across a model that seems to work. Now, you know, lots of ifs and buts and caveats, but we've seen a couple of big exits in the past 12 months alone. Even just this month, the New York Times bought The Athletic, and last year, we saw Axel Springer by Politico. And it's by focusing on just one discrete subject and getting a really passionate readership that is interested in that one theme you tackle, it seems as though it is possible to create, you know, sustainable news businesses.
Well, and it's interesting, too, in terms of what we're seeing, because it makes us, you know, what we find interesting is that, of course, we love media and we see, you know, we're all involved in it. And we certainly see a lot when it comes to video content and certainly streaming and online, but kind of more traditional media. I mean, you do wonder, is this just that there's so much money out there and it's just running into this? And could it turn out to be a big mistake?
Yeah, I think there is. It's certainly the case that not all of these are going to survive. You know, there is a lot of pasta being thrown at the wall. Only some of it is going to stick. I was a little bit sneaky in my piece where, you know, I asked, is anything fundamentally changed in the economics of news? And I've invoked Ethan Waugh, who wrote in his book Scoop, whenever the assistant to the big media mogul meant to say no, he actually said, up to a point, Lord Copper. So it's like, actually, not a huge amount has changed, but maybe there's enough money out there and people's news consumption habits have been put off enough by, you know, Google, Facebook, Twitter, what have you, that there's just about enough to keep some of them going.
So part of the difference here now, Alex, is also that we're not talking like general interest publications, right? We're talking like very targeted and niche audiences. Explain that a little bit more, because that's also like a little bit of a throwback to like what you would what have once called maybe trade publishing, right?
Yeah, it's really like, well, the examples we've got in the piece, and we talked about The Athletic, talked about Politico. There's also publications like Airmail, which is kind of like the luxury fashion magazine. It's been founded by Graydon Carter, the former editor of Vanity Fair. Protocol, which is basically a tech publication. Same with The Information. Axios, sort of that nexus of tech and politics. They all kind of go after these discrete segments. And the key thing is really trying to circumnavigate the big tech platforms. You want people to be coming directly to you, your audience to be coming to your website to find their content without having a media aggregating it for you. And so if people want their general news, there's a good chance they're still going to those big tech platforms. But if they want to find out what's happening in the world of tech, these new websites are hoping that they go directly to, for instance, The Information.
Okay, so say I have a friend who has some deep pockets and I have an idea for this thing that I want to do. What's the minimum buy-in? Like, how much money do you really need to actually attempt to get into this space, or at least the quote unquote successful launches that we're monitoring?
This real or hypothetical, Joel? I'm just curious.
It's not
purely hypothetical.
Okay.
In the grand scheme of things, it can be done for not a huge amount of money. You know, you're looking at some of these companies have raised in a sort of seed round of less than $10 million, which, you know, clearly is not nothing, but it isn't Quibi with, you know, $1.7 billion or whatever it was. And actually, that is part of the appeal of it, that you can go in for quite a lot less than $10 million, and you can get a lot for that money. You can get some really big name writers who will bring their audience with them, you would hope. Your setup costs are low because people are working from home. You know, cloud computing means it's not actually terribly expensive to set up a website these days. And so that also means there's quite a lot more upside for the investors who come in, because, you know, it's not that much of a risk for them to throw in a little bit at that level. If you're trying to compete throughout the gate with the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, it's a different challenge.
Hey, Alex, what's the Substack factor here? Because increasingly we see people who have names and followings, not necessarily going to an established media organization or even a startup organization, but going out on their own. What have we learned in the past couple of years as we've seen some people experiment to do this?
Well, I mean, Substack is very much like any social media platform where the early movers have a big advantage. The early movers get the big audiences, but the more people go into it, the harder it is to you know, turn a profit on the level that, or make a reasonable income on the way that the first movers did. And so, to a point, and you kind of think of Substack more as a tool increasingly for some of these new organizations. That Substack, you might build part of your business on Substack, you might build part of it on Clubhouse, you might build part of it on Twitter Spaces. You know, there are lots of different ways, but they're almost tools for these publications, or perhaps the first stepping stone before you build it into a broader media, you would hope, empire.
So what do you think, you know, Alex, in terms of this trend that's happening, is this going to be for some of these that do survive and provide some momentum in terms of a business, that they ultimately are tack-ons, add-ons for existing media outlets? How does this play?
Yeah, I wrote another column actually when the New York Times bought The Athletic. In a sense, you saw the original newspaper was the original bundle. An actual bundle arrives in the front door, and we've seen over the past 20 years a sort of great unbundling where people just get the stories they want. I think increasingly you're going to see big news organizations, the big established ones that have been around forever, start to acquire some of these smaller ones because they're buying in an audience, and it's a sort of rebundling whereby, you know, you might offer a subscription to the New York Times and an additional subscription to The Athletic, which is cheaper than buying them both individually. So I think that is going to be the exit for a lot of them. I'm not sure we're going to see massive media empires built in the way that some people might hope.
All right. Well, interesting perspective and trend, certainly, that's out there. Alex, thank you so much. Alex Webb, correspondent at Bloomberg Quick Take, joining us on the phone from London. His story is going to be in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. You can read it, though, now on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/Businessweek. And our thanks, as always, to Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, on the remote access from Brooklyn.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Peloton, the story that keeps on giving, Tim.
Just keep pedaling.
Keep pedaling. Well, activists are out big time already here in 2022. You know that the latest target, the once pandemic darling turned post-pandemic pariah. We're talking Peloton. So let's get to what's up. Scott DeVoe is with us, deals and shareholder activism reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone here in our New York City bureau. You've got to be busy this year, man. There is a lot going on when it comes to the activists.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch as much football as I wanted to yesterday.
I'm so sorry. They were really good games, one after another. Peloton. So they're checking out Mr. Foley. What's going on here?
So the investor, the activist in this, the stock is Blackwell's Capital, and they released a letter this morning essentially calling for Peloton to fire John Foley as CEO and to put the company up for sale.
And, you know, last week we heard analysts weigh in on this. And the idea that, you know, Apple or Alphabet, for example, Alphabet is what Jason Helfstein said over at Oppenheimer, could be a good fit to acquire Peloton. What are the other names being thrown around?
Nike, any kind of technology company, any kind of fitness company probably would fit well with this because of the data that it would bring. There's been a lot of speculation that these guys would be a very good target for a lot of companies.
Well, it's interesting, and it's a lot cheaper than it was, that's for sure. Tim and I were trying to figure this out. We thought that John Foley and a lot of other seniors controlled the voting shares. Are there a couple of different classes? Like, give us an idea.
That's the big problem here. Actually, it's an unusual time to go public, I guess, because the annual general meeting was held in December, so it'd be a full year before you could nominate directors to the board. And it does have a control block. They could prevent anything from going forward just based on that. So it does have a dual class share structure, which usually prevents activists from, you know, targeting those kind of companies.
So what is Blackwell saying about John Foley and about Peloton leadership?
Well, there's a litany of complaints, basically, that is in the letter. But essentially, Blackwell's is saying that they've failed on forecasting. They've had an inconsistent strategy in terms of pricing that's confused consumers and analysts. They have governance issues and a lack of financial controls. One of the big complaints is that John Foley told investors that there was no need for capital weeks before they did a $1 billion stock offering. And so there's just a very long list of complaints. And obviously, you know, last week the stock hit a 2-year low. It's down 80% since pandemic peaks when people were exercising from home at a higher rate. And it seems like, you know, Peloton's on its heels right now, and they're going public at a time when, you know, they really need to come up with a plan to fix the ship.
Well, Scott, you are the deals and shareholder activism reporter, so you cover a lot of this stuff. Is there anything that sticks out to you that's sort of different than the typical activist getting involved here?
I mean, it seems to me that it's a very typical target, and because it's a very high profile brand, that those things tend to attract activist investors. I mean, I think everybody knows what Peloton is, but maybe don't know that, you know, they're in a difficult position now. I mean, they've slashed their annual forecast by about $1 billion. The complaint in the letter is that Blackwell says, you know, you had a really good opportunity during the pandemic to turn people onto the Peloton product. But instead, what's happened is, you know, the stock has suffered as people are getting out of these, you know, pandemic restrictions and returning to the gym and whatnot.
Yeah, it doesn't help. Was it our social media buzz newsletter that went around too? That I guess Billions, the Showtime show Billions, featured a scene in which a character dies while running the bank as well.
No spoilers for people who aren't caught.
Oh, sorry. Sex and the City, I think. Yeah.
No, it's also Billions.
Okay.
It's the second time.
Everybody's dying on Peloton.
It's like, whoa. It is interesting though, and you do wonder if there were too many missed opportunities. What's the timeline? Do we have a timeline as investors as we watch this thing unwind?
So So Peloton has their earnings in a couple weeks in early February on
right.
the 8th. I would suspect that they would have replied at least to, you know, at least try to frame the narrative in some more favorable terms, but they've been completely silent at this point. So I think, you know, with that earnings coming up, that'd be an inflection point probably to see, you know, what their alternative plan to sale and firing John Foley would be.
All right. Well, investors all over the place. Stock's been down as much as 4.5% today. It's been up as much as almost 12% right now. It's a gain of 8.6%. So it does look like, Scott, that they're expecting something. Scott DeVoe, thank you so much. Deals and shareholder activism reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone in our New York City Bureau. What do you think?
I don't see Apple doing it. Apple builds its own hardware.
Yeah.
And this company has too much hardware. People would counter that with, oh, but Apple bought Beats years ago. Well, yeah, they bought it not for the headphones. They bought it to build the streaming platform on.
That's a really good point.
But other companies, perhaps. Look what Under Armour did with Map My Run.
Right,
maybe
exactly.
Nike does this.
And you do automatically get a certain base if you want to get into this market. $9.6 billion market cap as we speak. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
I'm definitely going to be eating mashed
potatoes. Explain what's going on, Carol.
So investors who want to be in this market, things have been on sale, right? It depends on which part of the market you're looking at. Small caps, large caps, tech, 10%, 20% lower. They've been on sale. And so you've definitely seen some buying. Let's see what Hank Smith has to say. See if he and his clients have been doing some buying. He is head of investment strategy at Haverford Trust Company. On the phone from Radnor, Pennsylvania, I said that I would have to eat mashed potatoes if we end in the green today. I do not like mashed potatoes, Hank Smith, and it looks like I'm going to have to be eating them because we are in the green.
Yeah, what a remarkable day for sure, Carol. Good afternoon.
Hi.
But look, this is we're now officially in correction territory for the S&P 500. This is the first correction in nearly 2 years since the bear market that ended on March of 2020. And that is so unusual to go this long. We were really spoiled last year. But at the same time, dare I say, we still believe this is a TINA market. There is no alternative because stocks still look much more attractive than bonds. Even though rates have come up, they're still, relatively speaking, very low. And people buying bonds today are buying losses if we continue to have higher interest rates. So I still believe that this is a market to buy these kinds of big dips.
Wow. I mean, but there was something that fundamentally shifted late in the day here because there was no dip buying happening in the morning. Do you think this was something technical? How do you explain it?
Well, No, you're absolutely right. And in the previous rallies earlier, you know, in the last several weeks, those were very temporary rallies. Those were opportunities to sell. But now that we have the correction out of the way, I think it's highly unlikely this morphs into a bear market because bear markets occur in anticipation of recessions. And it's really unlikely we're going to have a recession over the next 12, 15 months. You still have a consumer flush with cash and pent up demand to spend once we get a little clearer from this COVID. And you have corporate profits that are excellent. Sure, monetary policy is changing, but it's still stimulative, just not as much. And fiscal policy is still stimulus, but not nearly like we've seen last year. But I still think we're going to have decent economic growth, decent corporate earnings. Yes, more volatility this year, but last year was a very unusual year with almost zero volatility.
Hey, Hank, did you say bear market or bull market?
Bear markets, so the S&P now is down, depending on how we close today, down 11% off its peak.
Yeah.
That's correction territory. Maybe it goes a little bit lower. But we do not think this morphs into a bear market because bear markets occur in anticipation of recessions.
Hmm.
Well, but having said that, you know, there is that concern of a policy misstep. And often when a Fed moves into a tightening cycle, and we have this, we have a great story on the Bloomberg. It's actually citing, I think, Keith Lerner, who's over at Truist. He's their co-chief investment officer, and just points out that stocks have historically performed well, we know, during periods when the Fed raises rates. But at the, so we know we have that going on. But then our Megan Green, who we talked to, said that often you see when the Fed starts to raise rates that a recession follows.
Yeah, I think we have a long ways to go in a rate hike cycle before that threat comes. And let me lay out an optimistic scenario. Let's say Omicron is the last variant and COVID begins to fade from being a pandemic to something more manageable. You're going to see a couple things happen. You're going to see an acceleration and improvement in the supply chain. So you'll see more goods coming in. You'll also see a shift in demand away from goods towards services and experiences. So you could actually see goods deflation by the end of the year. Hmm. And that would give the Fed a lot more leeway to manage this interest rate hike, this shift in Fed policy.
So what's the challenge that Fed officials have in front of them today, Tuesday and Wednesday? And how do they talk around this?
Well, I think they have to stay committed to the bond buying is going to end by March, and interest rates will start to begin rising. And I think they're going to telegraph that very clearly. I do not think you're going to get a dramatic shift from that scenario, because I think that would put more fear into the market. I also don't think you're going to get anything more than a quarter point rate hike. But you can't rule out if inflation continues to get worse and gets out of control. You can't rule out a half point hike. Right. But we don't see that.
What do you make, though, that we're seeing this trade before we get a Fed decision on Wednesday? That's what I don't get. I really thought we'd be marking some time, and maybe that's what we get tomorrow. But how do you square that, what we're getting today, with what we maybe there are some unknowns in terms of what the Fed may throw us on Wednesday?
Well, I think this move, not only today, but in this month so far, has really been a reaction to the shift in Fed policy that is coming down the line. And perhaps, you know, the market is an anticipatory vehicle. And when we get to the end of bond buying and the beginning of rate hikes, we'll have already had the sell-off. That's our thinking right now.
Right.
And we don't think we're going to get any surprises in terms of verbiages from the next Fed meeting.
All right, we got to run. Hey, Hank, good to check in with you. Hank Smith, he is head of investment strategy at Haverford Trust, based in Radnor, Pennsylvania, and that's where we find him on the phone on this Monday.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.